Thank you, Alan, for your precision. You've come in absolutely on the knocker timing-wise. Listen, first of all, can I thank both of our experts? I could not think of a more comprehensive rundown of these spheres of challenge and opportunity that Australia finds itself in than these two gentlemen. So please give them another round of applause just as they are. And we do have some questions coming in. If you'd like to join the conversation, text on 0419 548 751. I wanted, before we get to these questions, Alan, to surprise you with one. We've been talking about the budget, obviously, that sort of fueled some of Chris's observations. One of the biggest changes in expenditure we've made in recent years is to foreign aid, and in this budget, the topography of those cuts was revealed, big cuts to Indonesia. How does that change affect our international relations at this point?
Yes, look, I think the thing about foreign aid is that for governments under fiscal pressure, as this government clearly is, it's an easy target, and particularly given the fact that the previous Labor government did put a lot more money into foreign aid. So it was a tempting target of, I think, off the top of my head, $5 to $6 billion in the foreign aid budget, which by global standards was passable. It wasn't a great contribution, but it was money sitting there that was a tempting target for any government to sit under pressure. And so the Abbott government did probably what a lot of governments would have done in the same circumstances. It cut it back quite substantially. So the question is, does it matter? Well, the government's argument is that, well, we're now using that money more effectively because it's targeted to our national interests. So there's two competing arguments about foreign aid. One is you do it for altruistic reasons. You don't link it to your national objectives. And the other sort of more realist, harder approach to aid is, well, we're happy to give aid, but it's got to be tied to our own economic development too. There's got to be a win-win for Australia. So the Abbott government's clearly taken the second line. My view is that it will have implications negatively for us over time if that is not redressed. So if we can actually get our aid budget back up again in 3 to 5 years, I don't think it's going to have long-term implications. But if we remain at the levels we're at now, it will be noticed by other countries. And given that we live in essentially a world of developing states, it means there are reduced opportunities for Australian influence and also for advancing Australia's interest, even by the standards of the current government. If you've got less money in the kitty, you're going to have less influence, particularly if other countries, comparable countries, are spending more money and so on. So I think it's going to be a net negative in the long run unless it's reversed.
Okay, there's a great question that's come through on the text, which I'm sure both of our panellists will have opinions on. A relentless optimist in the audience asks, the Cold War resulted in lots of innovation, so is geopolitical risk good for business?
Do you want me to answer that?
That's a Joe Hockey glass half full approach, right? Do you want to have a crack at that, Alan?
Well, I'm also a businessman as well as a risk analyst. So my answer is yes, of course it's good for business. But, you know, I'd have to say that if you ask me, would I rather have a quieter world geopolitically or a more volatile world, I'd rather have a quieter world, even though it mightn't work to my interests. Because let's face it, you can't have economic growth and prosperity if you've got military conflicts interrupting that kind of progress. I mean, the fundamental sort of underlying basis for economic development and prosperity globally is that you have the lowest level of geopolitical risk you can possibly live with. And Pax Americana, as I said, did provide that for basically half a century. Yes, sure, there were a lot of wars and conflicts going on, but there were no big wars, and certainly the volatility was taken out by the fact that the system was managed overall so that Asia and the developed world grew quite dramatically as well. So we all benefited from that. It's very difficult in the current environment to see how, even if your economic settings are right, how you can actually grow economies when you've got this level of geopolitical volatility. And the Middle East is a classic example of that. So really, at the end of the day, it's bad for business, I have to say.
Okay, Chris, any thoughts?
No, I can't add to that. Well done.
All right, we'll keep kicking along. We might head for domestic issues for a minute. There's a question here from the audience directed to Dr. Caton. If housing is driven by Sydney investors and medium-term fiscal repair is required, is capping or eliminating negative gearing part of the solution? Now, talk about risk management. This is a risk management issue for politicians who occasionally go on air saying we're going to fiddle around with negative gearing and then have to reverse gear. What's your view, Chris?
Well, I think one of the reasons why they do reverse gear is that a lot of their mates come along and say, hey, you know, I've got three or four properties negatively geared. It is apparently a very popular, should we say, investment vehicle on Capitol Hill itself. And that may well stand in the way of doing anything about it. The interesting thing is negative gearing actually doesn't work all that well right now because interest rates are so low. So you don't get all that much to deduct, if you like. But, it probably does have to be looked at. To me, it's not negative gearing per se, as the interaction between negative gearing and the capital gains tax. Basically, you buy a property, get to deduct all your costs at full value from your other sources of income, and then when you get to sell it, you pay tax on half of the capital gain. To me, it's that interaction that, if anything, is the issue. My suspicion is that if we could find a way to take a bit of heat out of the current investor boom, that would be handy. But I think by the time you got around to implementing a change to negative gearing, it would be too late. So I don't see it as necessarily a way to deal with the current situation. We should have thought of that before, if you like.
Plus, you'd have to grandfather it, wouldn't you?
But the other thing, I guess, about negative gearing is I think the idea that when we did restrict it in the mid 80s, the idea that this led to chaos in the rental market, I think if you look at it closely, is simply urban myth. It simply didn't happen. Although there were some increase in rents, is true, I believe, in Sydney and Perth, that I guess you could sheet home to that. But yeah, as I said, to me, it's mainly the interaction between negative gearing and the capital gains tax. Fix that, and you can keep your negative gearing, in my view.
Righto. Now, one of our audience members has asked us to consider Norway. Now, I know all economists breathe a deep sigh when they're asked to consider Norway, those smart Alex who set up the Sovereign Wealth Fund and didn't blow their minerals boom. Our correspondent reminds us they, in Norway, gained from the oil price boom in the 70s and increased benefits, then nearly went bust when oil prices fell. They had to increase taxes. The next oil price boom, they saved in a sovereign wealth fund. Should we be learning from Norway, Chris?
No. The question's in the wrong tense. We should have learnt from Norway. It's too late now. We don't have the oil, we don't have the commodity revenues coming in anymore. But in retrospect, it might have been a smarter way to have handled the commodity price boom 2002 to 2011.
You don't think there'll be any more booms ever?
I think there may well be. I don't know why you'd be planning on one anytime soon. When they come, they essentially, bearing in mind the relationship between worldwide commodity demand and supply right now, it's going to be a while coming. But yeah, next time, perhaps we shouldn't give it all away on the upswing.
Righto, we've got a question about nuclear. What's the likelihood of Australia going nuclear in the next 50 to 100 years? Are we always going to rely on America or our own conventional weapons in a region of increased national tensions? Now, I'd ask you both to interpret this as using nuclear not just in a defence sense but in an energy sense. The Premier of South Australia, Jay Weatherill, has recently asked the state look into the nuclear industry. It's a very dangerous thing for politicians to do, and we've waxed and waned on this historically in Australia. Can I ask you to give your views on this, Alan?
Okay, well, look, the first thing is 50 to 100 years, anything is possible, right? So it's pretty hard to sort of rule that one out entirely. But the first point is, in the next 10 or 20 years, could Australia go nuclear? In the sense, could we acquire nuclear capabilities and nuclear weapons? Your answer is probably not, because we don't have a nuclear industry to sustain it. Could we acquire one? Yes, we could. Do we have the capabilities? Yes, we do. But it would take a massive change politically for us to do that. And it would take a while to build the expertise you need in the country to sustain nuclear weapons, which I suppose then goes to Chris, and I'm sure Chris would like to make some judgments about whether we're going to have a nuclear industry. But the bottom line is, on the nuclear weapons side, we, of course, could acquire nuclear weapons from another country. I mean, if you talk about our submarine program, there's been a lot of discussion about what kind of new submarines Australia will get. And one of the proposals was to buy nuclear submarines from the United States. Nuclear in the sense that they're nuclear powered, they don't necessarily have nuclear weapons. But when both governments of both persuasions looked at this, they ruled it out because they didn't feel we had the nuclear industrial capacity to sustain that. So, I mean, that sort of really, you know, gives you an entree, Chris, into whether you think we should have a whether we can have a nuclear industry or not, I suppose.
Well, I guess, I mean, that's how I would interpret the question. Now, you know, 20, 30, 40 years from now, we can more seriously think about nuclear as a source of power and as a source of energy. And, you know, everybody knows the downside, potential downsides to nuclear, but compared with almost everything else from which, except renewables, from which we generate power, to me, the costs seem to be somewhere in the same ballpark or maybe even lower. So I think this is something that, you know, we seriously have to think about and keep on thinking about in the future.
Quickly, domestically, before we go back to international issues, one audience member, Chris, would like to know whether you think Australia will head into deflation territory.
Deflation. I guess if you're going to call deflation falling prices in aggregate, Australia's never been, well, hasn't been there in relevant economic times. My suspicion is we'd be the last developed country to go that way almost. Just to rehearse, right now it's true in the past year, the CPI I think is up by about 1.5%, but that's mainly because petrol prices are falling, and I don't see petrol prices falling as deflation. That's one price. The Reserve Bank's measure of underlying inflation is somewhere in the low twos, and shows no, well, basically has never really got down to less than 2%. Now, occasionally you get a shot across the bows. Last week we learned that we've only got about 17 years of comparable data, but wage growth in Australia is the lowest that it's ever been in that 17-year period. And, of course, eventually that's a potentially big driver of prices. But, up until say, or 10 years ago, nobody would ever have thought, hey, inflation can be too low. But now we believe that, as everybody else does, but we're a long, long way from deflation in it. And as I said, I think we'll be the last developed country to go there.
Right, we're going to head back to China for a minute. I'm sure that I'm not the only person who saw Alan's images of the militarisation in the South China Sea and found that extraordinary and fascinating and very compelling. We've had a lot of questions through about this tactical tightrope that Australia habitually walks between its biggest trading partner and its closest ally. Now, coincidentally, in the last week or so, we've had some interesting comings and goings about the possibility of B-1 bombers on Australian soil. As you'll recall, the US Assistant Secretary of Defence told a hearing in the States that there would be B-1 bombers based here, and that has now become, in that fabulous modern expression, a misspeak, and isn't happening after all. I suspect you might be able to shed some light on these developments for us, Alan.
Sure. This is a huge topic, so I obviously can't do justice to it now, but I'll just make a couple of points about the whole South China Sea developments. The first is that it's more than just the South China Sea. This is about what kind of China we're eventually going to see. And there are two diametrically opposed views about this. One is, it's the view of China that our rise is going to be peaceful and it's going to be a win-win for everybody else. And the opposite position is, well, it's going to be not a win-win for everybody else. It may be a win for China, but it's going to be a loss for a lot of other people if China continues to behave as it has in the South China Sea. So the point about the South China Sea is this indicative of the way China's going to behave, or is it not? And there's no answer to that, because it's the obverse face of China. The on the one side, we see the positive economic growth sort of this is a win-win for the world because we're going to bring everybody with us. That part of China, is the South China Sea represented of the other side of the face? Is it part of a singular strategy? Or is it sort of a kind of policy schizophrenia? That is, the Chinese themselves haven't made up whether they're going to be the bad China or the good China. That's one set of debates. Now, the second point I make is, if you just talk about facts on the ground, so putting aside what you think about China's rise and what it means, what my attitude as a geostrategic person is, forget about what people say and what countries say, right? Every country says nice things about their own policies, rhetorically. What is actually China doing? So the slides I just put up before are factual. They've been taken in the last 2 months. They show quite graphically what China is doing in the South China Sea. It's clearly a thought-through strategy. They're putting enormous resources in it, and it's pretty clear to me that they're for military purposes, really. So then the question is, what do we do about it? Do we accept that? Do we allow China to essentially take control of the South China Sea? Do we allow China to resolve disputes through military force? Or do we call it to account and say that's not acceptable? And if so, how do we do that? So there's some of the issues that South China Sea raises for us. And these are enormously important issues, particularly for Australia, because of our alliance relationship with the United States, the fact that China is our major trading partner, and we are uncomfortably have one foot, if you like, or one leg in both camps here. So where are we going to end up? It's hard to see.
Thank you for helping us navigate that tightrope. You know, there are more questions to ask, and I sense that we could be in the company of these two gentlemen for much of the day and still not get everything sorted out. We are out of time, I'm afraid. So can I ask you to thank them both very warmly for their time this morning?
Thank you.